Hey, Jamie, I've got a question for you.
What do you want, Tom?
Who's on the podcast this coming Friday? Is it someone big?
Boy.
Is it a big one? Shall I bother listening this week?
Yeah. If I was going to say take.
And I would say off.
No.
Your trousers.
No, no. Take.
Me out.
No. Take.
Paddy McGuinness.
No. Take.
Take on me.
Take that.
Wow.
Have a little patience.
But hang on, presumably you haven't got all three of them, have you? Presumably you've just got one of them.
Buddy, we have all three of them on the podcast. They've released a new album. It's coming out. They're going on tour. They talk about the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, on everything that happened in Take That.
The ins, the outs.
And they reveal it all this Friday.
Exclusively.
On Private Parts.
That's a big one. I'm going to listen to that.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to Whole Truth Podcast with myself, Jordan Stevens, aka... I always want to do an aka and I can't think of what another name
for
I want.
Yourself.
Well, I come up with a lot of different names sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I write down just lists of other names.
I like that.
Yeah, so do I. But it doesn't work well because I actually, interestingly, on my Amazon account,
uh-huh.
changed my name to Wilderness.
Ah, that's nice.
Because I thought that's funny. And yeah. then I missed the delivery.
Ah, right. Who's got a key? Shall
we do a little bump in the building? Anyway, welcome to the Whole Truth Podcast with me, Jordan Stevens, and I'm here with Thomas Page McBee, who has recently written a book called Amateur, a true story about what makes a man, which I had the privilege of reading before it came out.
I like that you're whispering.
I know, because it's a secret. I'm a massive fan of the book. And
thank you.
You're great. So let's get into it. How are you?
I am feeling very strange. I'm feeling strange because I'm jet lagged, so that's its own thing. But in the deeper sense, I think it's a strange time. I'm from the US and I'm transgender, and I'm also someone who thinks a lot about masculinity. So I think this is a time where a lot is shifting in a great way, and I'm excited to see it and to sort of have all of the dark things being exposed. But I also feel very afraid for my future and the future of other people, especially people younger than me who are like me. And I feel, on one hand, like I've been spending the last few days talking to people like yourself who are, you know, thoughtful and interested and want to have bigger conversations, which is really exciting. And then on another hand, I've been looking at my Twitter and like seeing headlines, especially here in the UK, about trans people that are really disturbing to me. So
can you explain what headline has been particularly troubling you?
There's a review of my book, a nice review in the Times.
Right.
And, but at the same, on the same day, I just happened to, you know, go back to the front page, and there was an op-ed by a guy who was, you know, saying really transphobic things. And,
really?
You know, yeah. And so, I guess like seeing even that juxtaposition is really strange for me.
Yeah.
Not that we have it all sorted out in America, but we don't do that. So I think that alone is kind of a,
You felt hostility and out of your own country in a place where you think it's more progressive maybe, but not.
Well, I know I know what's going on in the media here right now. So right now it's not more progressive for trans people in a certain way, but that's a new development, and that's, I guess it's upsetting to watch. I'm a big fan of the UK, so I'm not sure what the problem is right now.
I think sometimes it's, you know, it's the rational, logical brain that gets in people's way, and oh, there must be some and it's not, they're not actually sitting down and being compassionate.
Yeah. You know what I think? I think it's that there's an idea that it's a debatable thing.
Right.
Right? Like I'm sitting in front of you,
like
talking to you. Yeah, or even like, what's the debate? Like, we exist. So, I mean, like, what's even the conversation to be had, right? Like, I think that's what's wrong, is the whole framing. It's like, why is there even a conversation going on? Especially when you think about the fact that, at least in the US, I don't have the UK numbers, we're 1% of the population. So, you know, the idea of having national debates about whether or not we exist is something that's just hard to fathom, right? Yeah. Because what is this for? Like, I think this is about people who aren't trans, who feel anxious about gender identity, because we're living in a time where gender is changing. Men aren't sure what their place is anymore, you know,
etc. I mean, I can't wait to get into that.
Yeah, but like, that's what I think. I think this is like people need to come for their own. A big part of why maybe you don't see trans men telling stories also is that, you know, so much about stories about trans people in general are sort of marginalized into like this kind of othering, you know, violent othering of like, you know, we're these aliens who come and we're born in the wrong body and then we turn into these people who have the right bodies. And it's this very like, you know, like keeping the space between us, when in fact, actually, I think what we can offer is, you know, we're regular people who've had a very extraordinary life experience that I think reflects on gender in a broad way.
I mean, And I'd find it difficult to fathom how anyone can feel affected by an existence that like just doesn't affect them.
Sure.
That has no imposition upon their experience. Right. Like just now I was hearing a thing about homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, I think to a lot of people, this radio presenter was kind of being like, on a logical, rational level, it doesn't make sense how you can have that.
Yeah.
To the extreme prejudice, but it's like the fact that people are putting in actual infrastructure to be like, no, this is something that's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know.
It does make sense, because the way that we socialize boys, literally, culturally, is to believe that, you know, within that idea of the man box, just to like get into it for a second. I mean, this is something that was the most important thing I learned in this book. So okay, I always try to say it at every interview.
Yeah,
but like,
of course, it's something I'm very passionate about.
Yeah. But like every question the point of the book was I was training for this fight in Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, of course.
And as I was training, every moment of the training where something uncomfortable came up for me, a question about being a man, I just wrote it down. And then at the end, I went and reported out all of those questions. And so every one of those questions, from like, you know, what is a real man, to like, am I sexist? Because that came up. It all led back to...
Yeah, just saw that.
Yeah. It all led back to, once I talked to people, this idea of like, all of these ideas about masculinity that we're talking about when we say toxic masculinity, which of course is not all masculinity, but a certain socialized set of behaviors, we learn them all in boyhood. And we all people who are boys learn them in boyhood. So 100%. And I missed that part, you know, so I learned it at 30. So I have the frontal lobes in order to actually understand what's happening.
Yeah,
but
you're conscious of it.
Conscious of it, yeah. But like that idea of the man box, that's like a real thing, that where they go in and talk to like 10-year-old boys, sociologists do this, and they draw a box on the board and they say, what is a real man? And the boys will always say things like, you know, being powerful, not showing emotion. Like 100%. Literally all the time. And they've picked this up from our culture. So I think one thing that I think we are doing wrong when we're talking about men is not having empathy for those boys, because it's not fair to expect a child to understand the difference between, you know, like being toxic and not being toxic, when that's exactly what we teach them. I think where my empathy ends is once we're talking about this with men who, from the place of like, look, you've been socialized in this way. You've learned that dominating women, you've learned that not being girly, not being gay, I'm putting that in quotes because that's literally what the psychologist I talked to described her decades of work with boys. Like that's the way they describe being a man.
Still.
Yes.
Still.
So they've learned homophobia as part of...
Yeah, femininity. It's a fear of femininity.
Yes, exactly. And so
it's displayed and they go, oh my God, this is wrong. You're being... Yeah.
And they've learned that in order to be a man, you have to keep protecting your masculinity. Like,
but also I think I think one thing I also want to make a line between is homophobia and hardwired misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also think there's a massive strain of that within the gay community.
Of course.
Within the male gay community, I think there's like loads of misogyny that occurs.
Well, because they were boys too. It's just that they happen to be gay.
Right.
Yes. You have to undo this all. Like it has to be a conscious effort. You don't get like a pass. And that's why you can't call yourself a good man. That's a separate note. But like there's no such thing as a good man. For there to be a good man, there has to be a bad man. Yeah. It's not useful to call people good men, because then no one looks at themselves. You just get to like, you know.
It's evasive.
And it's
and everyone exists.
Yes.
I think the more conscious you are of your shadow, the more likely you are to be in control of your, you know, your actions.
And the more liberated you are, frankly, it's to your benefit to actually have
morality's a killer.
Right. Relationship with yourself, because, you know, this isn't about proving. And I think for men we learn that to be a man, you have to prove your masculinity. That is very strange.
It's repetitive, yeah.
If you just think about it for like 5 minutes, it is very weird, the idea that to be a thing that you already are, you need to constantly prove and protect that thing, uh-huh. and that it can be policed or taken uh-huh. away from you. But that's the definition of toxic masculinity.
How does that feel to pick up a newspaper and feel separate? Mm-hmm. And what do you do in yourself to bring a sense of calm or positivity?
I think I've focused. I mean, so recently, I'm now in my later 30s. So I transitioned at 30 and I'm now in my later 30s. And I've been thinking a lot lately about young people. And I worked with teenagers, you know, before I transitioned. I taught high school and I've always been involved with young people. And I think because I didn't see anyone like me when I was young, I'm really conscious of having a place where I can theoretically like be the person that I never saw as a young person.
That's quite something to transition at 30.
Yeah.
That which is in the book, this book Amateur, which is why I think it's like gold dust right now in this climate, because you talk a lot about the performative aspects of masculinity or learning
mm-hmm.
after having lived another learned mm-hmm. experience.
Mm-hmm.
What was the moment when you thought, okay, I need to be who I really am, mm-hmm. and what did you not expect in that journey?
Yeah, well, I didn't have a moment where I knew that I needed to be who I really was. Not really, because I spent my whole life being very androgynous, you know, and in some ways very resistant to the idea of having to have a gender, or one that was legible. Like I was always very queer, but then I think. For me, actually, over time, I think gender dysphoria is a real thing, and I had it. And so eventually it was sort of just many years of that buildup.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, and it was exhausting. And eventually I actually had this very kind of spiritual year or so where I kept imagining sort of this vision of myself. And I write about it in my first book, but it was like I saw this guy sitting at my kitchen table and he had this beard. And I would sort of see him, like I wasn't sleeping well because I was considering transitioning and I was just realizing what a big life change that would be and
yeah.
what I could lose and having no idea how the people in my life might react and
right.
thinking about names. And it was just it was a very intense time. And so because of that, I felt like it was important sort of to go through this experience of just feeling strange. And so I kept imagining this man and he was sort of bearded and had, you know, dark hair and looked like me, but not like me.
Right.
And I knew it was me. And then, you know, in the last few years, I've been like, that was, it's literally what I look like, you know?
Really?
I pictured myself. It was really strange.
Oh,
yeah.
Whoa.
So that's what it was like. It was like this, like, I guess any big life transition where that's like a scary one, you know, I think anybody can relate to really the feeling of, I know I need to do something differently. Something's not working, but I'm taking a chance, but I don't know what it's going to look like on the other end. And I especially actually once I was on testosterone, once I started, I was really connecting to pregnant women who were, I just happened to have a lot of pregnant friends at the time. And like, we really could connect around like, you know, obviously getting, you know, the hormonal stuff and and the homeostasis that has to happen over time. It's not like you immediately are all sorted out. Like your body has to adjust and just not knowing who you're going to be on the other side of it. Like, what are you going to look like? What's your life going to be like? Is this the right choice? So once I transitioned, I think what was really interesting and where this book came from was like, you know, I transitioned and I think often we hear stories about trans people and they just end with the transition. It's like, oh great, you did it. You know, hooray, triumph. And I think that makes sense because, you know, there is a lot about, you know, people love authenticity and stories of authenticity and it is about being your authentic self. That's not wrong. But I think what's more interesting to me is what happens next, you know? And for me, you know, basic identity formation, the way it works psychologically is first you figure out who you are, then you figure out your place in the world.
Yeah.
So for me, once I knew who I was, what it felt like was, oh, when I'm in my apartment, I feel great. I feel awesome. I feel like incredible in my body. I feel like I really am myself. I feel great. And then I left my apartment. I would leave my apartment and it was like everything about the way the outside world treated me felt dissonant, you know, like my sense of what it was to be a man for me was not at all lined up with the expectations of masculinity. And so that's everything from the privileges I got, like in terms of, you know, immediate privilege, because I'm also a white man. So it's like the amount of I can't even describe what a wildly different experience that was, you know, like, because I was this androgynous queer person who suddenly has this legible gender. Yeah. I'm white. I'm a man. I'm in my 30s. So I'm like getting promotions. I'm getting like,
serious.
Yes. Yo. I'm when I speak in a meeting, everyone listens. Like, no one ever interrupts me. When I'm walking around at night, I feel safe. Women walk away, you know, across the street to be, you know, not near me, like, because I'm a threat all of a sudden. I mean, yeah. All of those things. So that was obviously upsetting and distressing, yeah, and something I thought I need to figure out what to do about this. And then the other side of that was the constrictions of masculinity. Like, I felt suddenly very much like, so much of what I prided myself on as a person, you know, being empathetic, being the person who could be emotionally present to other people, like, yeah, being able to be vulnerable about myself, like, those things were suddenly policed, like, almost relentlessly by everyone in my life. And so I was living in what, you know, sociologists call a man box, which is like this very narrow definition of masculinity that I felt myself being forced into without really my consent, but it was almost impossible to even understand what was happening, you know. But it's just like suddenly, like, nobody was touching me. And if I was sad, people were weird. But if I was angry, everyone was okay with it. And that was, you know, that was sort of the landscape of my life before I wrote this book and where the book came from. I was in a pickle, but I picked it up. Now I do pingers and I stick them up.
It's been a while since I missed the bus. And to be honest, I missed the rush. So I just want to ask you what your favorite color is.
My favorite color? Well, I've been going hard on pink lately, actually. I don't look good in it, is the thing. I wish I did.
Well, what type of pink?
In terms of what?
You could do a pastel pink.
But it's like I get like a kind of yellowy tone. It really? Just doesn't look right on me. Yeah, but in terms of...
I think it would.
Really?
I think a pastel pink.
Really?
Yeah, not a fuchsia pink.
Okay. I'm gonna follow this advice and I'm going to send you a picture of myself.
Yeah, not salmon.
Not pastel. Salmon. Yeah, right. Okay.
It's a little lighter.
Yeah, but there's no yellows in that.
No, I think the yellow is salmon.
All right. So,
is there any reason why?
I mean, I think, you know, honestly, like with my American book cover, like I really wanted it to be pink. So it is, which for obvious reasons. And I just feel like, you know, it's sort of an aggressive move on my part, but I just feel like going hard with the pink has been really a big part of my life lately.
I wonder what the start of that is. Does anyone know?
The millennial pink?
No, like the fact that there's pink and blue.
Oh, I do know. I do know, but not as in much detail as I should. I do know that it used to be the opposite. I know that it used to be that boys were associated with pink boys' clothes and girls were associated with blue. What? And then something happened, and this is the part we can Google it, but something happened with, there was like a manufacturing thing and something happened and then there was a switch. But this was in like the 1800s. So it was always, girls were blue, boys were pink. Maybe it was easier to produce whichever color, you know, girls got.
This is what I mean.
I mean, it's so stupid, right?
Tom, I can't. This is what I mean about life, yeah?
Yes, it's what I mean about life.
I wanted to say something I just remembered. When we were talking about responsibility and to not put the... necessarily, to empathize more with the young boys who are unaware of the conditioning they're experiencing.
Right.
Yeah, I really think the push, which can almost be a bit... shovey, mm-hmm. a bit more, is with fathers. And I think it is a responsibility of this generation, whatever generation, even now, even if your kid's 20 and you're 50,
yeah,
it still is to go, just relax the shoulders and just be like, actually, because it's shown, if you just love a child for whatever they want,
that's
and that
right.
can be masculine, that can be feminine,
that's right.
then they respond
yeah.
and they're just happier.
Yeah. When I have to give, I mean, parents tend to come to my talks and my readings, especially parents of trans kids. And they say like, you know, what advice do you have? And so for parents of trans kids, my advice is always like, just love your kid. Like there's no right way, you know, just love your kid. End of story.
It's pure love.
But I also get often this question of like from parents of boys, how can I be a better parent to my boy child? How can I make sure my boy doesn't end up, you know, in this man box, etc. And my advice, which they never like, is realize you have a gender, because if you are trying to help him understand about all of this, but you yourself have never thought about your own body and space, uh-huh. how will he understand? How can, if you don't model, in a sense of like inquiry about yourself, you're not teaching your kid how to do that. You're just giving them some like talking points that are, you know, liberal talking points, but that's not the same, you know? The color, my favorite color is pink.
Hey, Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How old were you when you first became conscious of mental health, I'd say? When you started to realise, like, ah, maybe I'm feeling this way because of things.
Yeah. You know, I don't know, because it's hard for me to know the answer to that, because my childhood was really, it was a pretty traumatic childhood.
Right.
And so my own feelings were kind of not the front of my own mind. You know, I think if you grow up in an abusive household, like, your experience of yourself is not separate from your abuser or from, like, the environment, if that makes sense.
Right.
But I guess for that reason, reading was such a respite for me, because I would find empathy and my sense of self in books, because I read really young, and I would have this time to myself where I could relate to people that I was reading about. And that gave me a sense of, like, echolocating who I was, because I could see, you know, I'm connected to this character. Yeah. Like, and also to see all the ways the world existed beyond my experience, you know, that there were so many models of being a person or having a family or having a life that were not what I was experiencing in, you know, in the worst time of my life, you know? So I think that's where I got a sense that my own body was separate and mattered, and that I could connect to others, even just in my mind, you know? And so, and it sort of was a roundabout way to do it, but that is how I ended up seeing my own feelings as my own. But did you find a place? Like, for me, books were a place where I could be my whole self, even if it was just in that period.
Well, in my own head, I suppose.
Yeah.
But people have argued, actually, that that's the root of my ADHD. Because you kind of go into your head as a safe space.
That makes sense.
But I don't know where I say Sonic. I read a lot of Sonic the Comic as a kid.
Yeah. There you go.
That's probably why. Yeah, I don't know. So what would you say has been your best period of mental well-being?
This one. I'm in it.
Love it.
Yeah, I'm in it right now. And it's weird because the world feels like it's falling apart. But I guess, you know, it's not because of luck. It's because of hard work. It's because of all of the things I've had to do to get here.
Yeah.
And I feel prepared, you know? And actually, my fight feels actually a very big part of that. And speaking of anger, you know, something people often ask is, like, what was the most surprising thing you learned in boxing? And for me, like, it was that I was never, like, a violent person or anything, but learning how to fight as a trans person, as a person who was queer, as a person from a marginalized identity, learning how to fight is something that I needed to know. And I feel like now I'm ready to fight for things that matter to me.
Yeah.
And so in this time that's really challenging, that I feel like is obviously getting a lot of people down, I feel I have the privilege of having learned to fight, and therefore can fight for people who don't have that yet, you know? And so that gives me such a sense of well-being that I've not had before.
That's something I try and remind myself. I've got a good friend of mine who does that, and he feels a bit down. He asks someone how they are.
Yeah.
It just sounds...
or do something nice for someone else. Yeah. You know, that thing. But it's really true, because also then you feel empowered again. Yeah.
I love that. Okay, great. And I mean, maybe you hinted at already with discussion of your childhood, but what would you say has been your worst period of mental health?
I don't know if it was my childhood. I think it was actually after my mom died.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think for a lot of reasons, I was only 4 years into my transition, which sounds like a long time, but I had moved to a new city. I was in New York. So being new to New York is...
At the same time?
I had moved to New York a year before my mom died.
Right.
And so that was 3 years into my transition. Moving to New York is hellish. Yeah. It's like, it's really hard to explain how awful it is. Like the whole first few years you're there, people are like, oh, how long have you been here? Oh, 2 years. Oh, you're new. Mm. Yeah. So you're new until 10 years technically. Wow. But it's, it gets better after about 4 or 5 years, but the first year is just,
no one cares.
No one cares. And you do I did everything wrong. I lived in a weird apartment. There were like roaches. There was a crazy roach problem. I had to leave. There was a woman next door who had her television against my wall, and she would head up all the way.
No.
Yeah, and then I tried to get her headphones for her television because she was like this old lady and she wouldn't use them, and it was just like, and then I lost my job, and like then I was like, how am I even gonna find an apartment and live? And it was just one hellish thing after another. And then my mom got sick. And she died very suddenly, and that was hellish. So, and then I was dealing with all this stuff around masculinity where I felt like I didn't have a lot of friends in New York yet. And so it was a real, like, that whole year was my turning point year where I think it could have gone really badly. And I think that's what I mean about sort of having like the fighting and the boxing really was my way out of something that could have been really bad, honestly, but ended up really good. And I feel like I had to really claw my way out of, you know, it's not just New York. It's like, the reality of being trans and having to go through all of this hit me. I also, at that time especially, was like, will I be able to find a job? I don't know what my life, I don't know what being a trans man in this world is going to mean. Like, will someone Google me and not rent me an apartment? Like, yeah, I had no idea. So
that's scary.
Yeah. And just, you know, to say too, like, you don't know when you we still don't know what are the actual health effects of transitioning. Like, right. I might be more at risk for cancer. There are some studies that say that. We don't know. Like, so many things felt up in the air and unclear, and it was so early on. And I also was feeling like I'm not even being my authentic self after all this because of all of this socialized masculinity that I was up against. So that was a really bad time.
Did you find that affected your grieving?
Massively. I think that was the biggest drive for me about this book. I mean, the book starts because it starts in the book, and also this is what started the book was, you know, I kept getting into these weird street fights with guys, and they didn't turn into fights, but sort of street altercations.
They was almost alien to you.
Alien to me, but I think I was walking around so angry because I had so much grief, and I couldn't express the other parts of the grief because it was just impossible. And so I think I was flagging to people who also were angry. Like, it was almost like a weird flare. Like, you know, I'm angry, you're angry, and then guys would try to fight me. And I really felt like if I didn't address that, I was going to become the guy who was trying to fight me, you know, like, and I needed to change it. So yeah, I think all of that combined made that the worst time of my life. I'm so glad it's over.
But it could possibly have laid the foundations for the best part.
That's what I think. Well, I think that's true.
Well, I think of, everything is the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, every time I get a night off, I see a whole lot of bunnies and I want the covers on my watch. Gotta watch my life at all costs. So fuck it, shit's amazing. Treating life like it's a painting. It's so scintillating, ain't it? Maybe need some changes.
Yeah. Are there any specific songs or artists or albums that define either a really positive time, negative time, or something you can't listen to anymore, that kind of thing?
Wow. I've been really revisiting Kate Bush.
Right.
Who I feel like is a perennial queer icon. Like, I just feel like for whatever reason, I mean, she sort of, like, someone gave me a mixtape in, like, you know, 1995 or something with her album on it, which came out in 1985. Uh-huh. And then I was like in the car the other day and I had some friends who were lesbians who were listening to Running Up That Hill. And that's a song that I've been like sort of revisiting like recently. I'm interested in music that bridges my identities. Yeah, I've lived a lot of lives and especially like, you know, obviously around gender and being queer and how do I integrate, you know, like, because I'm married to a woman, you know, and I'm a man. And so, but I had this whole life before that. And how do I kind of integrate all of it? And I really feel attracted to music that reminds me of my whole self. Of course. Kate Bush, like, and especially that song, it's so touching. And it's like, I feel so emotional when I hear that song, but it's in so many different ways and it's so layered that it's like cathartic to listen to it, you know.
Love that.
Yeah.
Are there any songs that you can't like, that you like can't listen to? Do you know what I mean? One of those ones where it's like, I have a few, like an album where you were taken back to a time and you're like, no, I can't.
That you don't want to hear again. I mean, I think there's probably a million of those albums. I'm just trying to think of one off the top of my head. I actually feel like recently I've been having the opposite experience of wanting to revisit music, but you know, like for me, like right after I transitioned, I wanted all the photographs of myself from before to put like put away. I didn't want to see any pictures from my childhood. I didn't want to see any pictures of like, I just wanted them all gone. Right. And in the last couple of years, I've been really like reintegrating all of these images of myself, you know? And yeah, it's been, and not all of them, but, you know, especially after my mom died, it was like important to me. Like these are pictures. Also, my mom was in these pictures. Like this is my life. And so, so I think I've been on a bigger campaign to sort of revisit, you know, music and revisit, like, I will say, I love Paul Simon. I love that album Graceland. That's been a harder one to revisit because when my mom was dying, we listened to it a lot with her because it was an album that she really loved. And like growing up, we all listened to this album together, like in the car. And then when she was dying, we played it for her when she couldn't really talk. And so that's been something that I've been sort of creeping up on listening to that. Like I'll listen to a song here and there and I'm like, whoop, all right, like that's enough of that, you know?
Yeah, but that's quite an amazing barometer of grief because it's so gradual. I mean, it never goes, right. But it's so gradual, isn't it?
And it's death can be a trauma. Like I think my mom's death was certainly a trauma. And 100%. So for me, it's like, I know with trauma, I've had enough of it. You've got to figure out how to sort of titrate it back into your life. And for me, music is a way that I've been able to do that. So
it's patience, isn't it?
Yeah.
My mom has already specified to me what song she wants played at her funeral.
Oh, wow.
So that's...
Better get used to listening to that now.
So I was just like, oh, cheers, mom. It's nice for you to tell me that when I'm 10.
Yeah, right.
It is quite... In the same way as you described the relationship with books.
Yeah.
That's something I find so mad about music because coming from a background of loving rap, there's so much in like the cadence of a sentence and the way a lyric rhymes. And I think actually there isn't enough credit given to...
Oh, rap, totally.
I don't think. However, you know, I myself have also like writing singing songs. Sometimes I actually can't write raps for whatever reason because there's something in my body that translates easier because there is a lot said in melody, I think, which is weird.
No, that makes sense.
It's like a conceptual emotion kind of thing, you know, where it's like you can say a whole thing and map it out beautifully. Lauryn Hill can rap a whole verse and you go, I exactly understand where you're from. But then someone can just be like, oh, I feel it.
Yeah.
And then you're like, what?
Well, it's something. There's something about the emotion. It's sort of like poetry versus reading a sort of more straight story.
Sure.
Like there's the way that you know, it's not the individual sentence in poetry that gives you the feeling. It's the whole thing together. And you're trying to create an experience of feeling for someone. Yeah. Music, I think, creates that experience.
Yeah. It's that ambiguity. You know, people find a lot in the ambiguity, don't they?
Yeah.
In a question where you have, this is it. This is your perspective. And then there's a little bit in between, which is the art.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got a thing called Whole Hour as well, which is encouraging people to just take an hour out of their day.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with your whole hour?
In terms of what I do regularly with my free hour, I actually have free 2 hours that I use regularly to go see movies. Mm. I see movies all the time.
Do you see them on your own as
Yes,
well?
Yes, I love seeing them by myself.
And you wait till right at the end of the run so you're in the cinema alone too.
I love that.
You can put your feet on the seats in front and throw popcorn at imaginary people.
Well, I don't throw the popcorn.
Okay,
besides
so because people have to clean.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and is there anything you would say to someone listening to the podcast who's potentially having a bit of a tough time?
I think that people know innately what they need. And I think that usually when you're in the hardest time, what is especially hard is all the pressure you feel to like be better or to you know, do something for someone else that you're supposed to be doing or the responsibilities you have. And I think almost always for me, the thing that works best is to this hour idea, to stop what you're doing, you know, take some time for yourself and see it as time that is actually going to help you. This isn't about like you failed or you're lazy or this is literally like part of the process that you need to get in touch with yourself. And once you are in touch with yourself, always you know what you need to do next. Always.
Thank you so much.
Oh, this was so fun. Yeah.
If you would like to subscribe to our podcast, please click subscribe. So just thanks for listening, really. And look after yourselves.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Powered by Spirit Studios.